Next up is This Week in Law. We've got Cal Rausdiala from The Knockoff Economy, entertainment lawyer Charles Harder, Evan Brown, and me. And we're going to talk about China's unique perspective on copying, Mega, and whether its encryption is enough to shield it from liability, and what kind of stuff are folks tweeting out there. We're going to talk about all that and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 196, recorded February 1st, 2013. Splashing Ignominy. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ShareFile by Citrix. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter Twill. And by LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your direction, such as affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TWILL to receive $10 off at checkout. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, your host of the show, along with Evan Brown in Chicago. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy Friday. Hope everything's going well with you.
Everything is going great. Great to see you again, as always.
Same here.
We have two wonderful guests this week on This Week in Law. Joining us from UCLA Law School, co-author of The Knockoff Economy, is Cal Rausdiala. Hello, Cal.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. We're so glad you could join us. And also joining us from the land of angels, Los Angeles, California, is an old friend of mine, Charles Harder. Hello, Charles.
Hello, Denise, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Charles and I started out as baby lawyers together long ago in the deep, dark, Jurassic, almost Reagan years. Charles has certainly come a long way. He has his own law firm these days, and I think of him as the lawyer to the stars because he does handle a lot of high-profile entertainment-related matters. So it's great to have you and your perspective, Charles.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Okay. Oh, and congratulations to you on your new firm.
Thank you. Thank you. It's coming along well. We're 1 month old as of now.
Very exciting. Right on. All right. Well, let's get right into it. And since we've got a couple of folks very conversant in entertainment law issues, let's go there first.
Oh, it is California.
All right. And having just briefly gone to Hollywood, let's also go to Antigua and Barbuda, because they are much in the news this week and have gotten themselves in a situation where they're going to be able to legally offer copyrighted works for sale without having to pay royalties or otherwise have permission to carry those works. Cal, you've written about this in some detail. Help us understand how this has happened.
Sure. So this is the outgrowth of a longstanding dispute between the United States and these islands related to online gambling. And it's taking place in the context of the World Trade Organization. So you might not think that the World Trade Organization and intellectual property law go together, but back in the 90s, when the United States helped create, and we really were the motive force behind creating this WTO, this new WTO, one of the things we wanted to do was put IP law into that. And so we pushed through successfully a kind of side agreement, normally known as TRIPS, for trade-related aspects of intellectual property. And TRIPS mandated that WTO members have kind of minimum standards of intellectual property protection. And so it was one of the ways that we wanted to make sure that developing countries and other countries who maybe weren't so protective of IP protected it. So the irony of what's happening here with Antigua is we have this dispute going on about online gambling. Antigua has basically won that dispute before the WTO court. It's called the appellate body. And normally countries can suspend obligations under the WTO if the loser does not comply with the ruling. The U.S. is not complying with the ruling. And so the typical way that people do it is they raise tariffs on goods or something like that. But for a tiny island, that's not really an effective strategy. So what they proposed, and they're not the first, other states have proposed this in the past, is, well, what if we suspend our IP obligations? Can we do that to the tune of $21 million a year or a day? I can't remember what the exact figure was, but to an amount that meets whatever the harm that we've been suffering. And the WTO has essentially said, yes, go ahead and do that. And so that's an unusual twist. So the U.S. is very unhappy, and of course Hollywood is very unhappy.
I'm pretty sure it's $21 million a year.
Yes, I think you're right.
So that is that is a lot of money, but not what it could be, I guess.
It does raise a lot of questions about how you calculate that. If you're mm-hmm. permitting illegal, or I should say unauthorized downloads, how do you calculate that 21 million figure? When do you hit it? Do you assume that every download is a lost sale, which is Hollywood's favorite way of calculating these things? You know, that has a host of problems. Most importantly, most people will get things for free if they can, and they wouldn't necessarily have purchased them. So it'll be interesting to see how this is actually implemented, if in fact it is implemented. And I think there's reason to doubt that this will ever really happen. But at the moment, it's moving in that direction.
Right. It sounds like they have quite a bit of leverage now to negotiate something.
Right.
And that those negotiations are underway. Charles, have you looked at this? And what are your thoughts on legal piracy in the Caribbean?
Well, obviously, I'm not in favor of legal piracy anywhere because I represent talent, and talent makes its living off of people complying with intellectual property laws. And also, they do business with the studios who make their living off of the same thing. So to the extent that all countries can be encouraged and required to comply with the usually accepted rules of intellectual property law, including copyrights and trademarks and everything else. But I haven't studied this issue very closely, so I can't really get into the details of it.
Evan, I think this is a pretty just kind of an irony here that if you live by the WTO, you also die by it, apparently, because. You know, in most instances, the U.S. makes out pretty well being a member of the WTO for intellectual property purposes, but it's certainly gotten bitten here.
That's right, and that's a good way of looking at it, live by it and die by it as well. It certainly is a unintended consequence of the framework, and you know, when it is worked out this way in this framework, it's certainly not what anybody would have anticipated when, you know, this framework was established a number of years ago. And so, you know, I haven't studied the nuances of it either. I have, you know, it's enough effort for me to just be a good lawyer when it comes to domestic issues, and when, you know, we talk about larger issues that online cyber law, for lack of a better term, these types of international issues that cyber law gives us. I know they're really nuanced, and that there's all kinds of wonkish talk to be made about it. And I'll leave that to Cal, you know, because he's good at that stuff. But I see this not so much as a copyright issue as just some mechanism by which Antigua was doing what it could in retaliation for the U.S.'s stance on gambling. So copyright just happens to be the manifestation of the dispute, not necessarily anything intrinsic with copyright law, other than it being a useful means to gain leverage in this way. So I have no idea. I don't really have enough insight to say how this would go out, but I'm intrigued by what Cal says. When he speculates that that it's unlikely that we'll see something actually bad happen in the copyright front here. So it's one of those things where I'll wait on the sidelines and see what's going to happen in the next year or so.
You know, so, I think Evan made a lot of good points. If I could just jump in on that. I think he's right to say that, you know, one, this is I don't know for sure whether anyone anticipated this in the U.S. government when we pushed through – this is back in 1994 – pushed through the TRIPS agreement. Probably nobody did, but it's possible. But either way, I think it is a sort of ironic consequence, because really what we were trying to do is strengthen copyright protection primarily, but also patent protection around the world. And now we're sort of being and we're trying to use the leverage that the WTO has, and it has a lot of leverage because of these enforcement mechanisms. So that's now being flipped against us in a way that's obviously troubling to many here in Los Angeles, but also throughout the country. So the reason I guess I think that we'll try to negotiate a settlement, which is always possible, is that the precedent is disturbing. So even though the amount, $21 million a year, you know, if you really think about what's at stake, that's pretty small. But the precedent is disturbing to the U.S. And the only other thing I'd add to what Evan said is all of these WTO disputes, when they occur and there's retaliation for noncompliance with a ruling, there's always someone who gets caught as collateral damage. So the typical way that we do it in a trade dispute is we'll say, like, let's say it's with Europe, with the EU, we'll pick luxury goods or, you know, farm, like maybe cheese from the south of France or something like that, where we know, and we'll slap 100% tariff on that. And we know that those farmers are going to go ballistic about that. And they had nothing to do with the underlying dispute, but we know that they will really push on the government of France and of the EU to change whatever law is at issue. So Antigua is using that exact same strategy. They know that the studios here are really, really worried about this idea. Not so much the 21 million maybe, but the fact that this could be a new front in the copyright wars. So they're going to push really hard on the U.S. government, figure out a way to make this go away. And that's exactly what Antigua wants to have happen.
That I mean, it's doubly smart on their part, really. And you know, that makes perfect sense. What you're saying, what their strategy is here. Not only are they using the studio's interest as leverage and kind of touching on that sentiment, that sensibility of the studios, but this is already a raw spot in the public discourse about this, only just a right. little bit over a year after ACTA and all that stuff. So not only is there likely to be the actions taken on the part of big content, but also then to an equal or certainly a vocal extent, there is the possibility for the sentiments of that, what we saw with the blackouts on January 18th of 2012, et cetera.
Right.
Cal, what is the state of intellectual property law globally right now? I know that you follow these issues. You've written a book on the evolution of territoriality in American law. And it just seems so very confusing for anyone who's doing business online in any way these days, because the laws that they have to comply with vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and country to country. They can be extradited and hauled into court in places perhaps they never imagined that they could be. There's just a lot of confusion here based on the fact that every country is sovereign and has its own laws. Do you see any resolution to this in the near future?
You know, it is complicated. You're absolutely right. There are, IP law, like most law, is territorial and is varies by jurisdiction. And in the world of IP, there are some differences. I think the biggest differences, though, really go to things like, are these laws enforced and how are they enforced and how are they implemented? In part because of things like the TRIPS agreement that we just talked about a moment ago. So every WTO member state is a signatory to TRIPS. It's part of the deal. And there's about 150 members, and they're the biggest economies in the world, the most important. So they've all signed on to kind of minimum standards. And of course, there are these other treaties through the World Intellectual Property Organization in Geneva that also mandate certain shared visions of how to deal with not only copyright and patent, but trademark and other aspects. So I would say if you look around the world, there are not wild differences in law, but there do tend to be some pretty big differences in enforcement. And China is probably a great example of that. So I was in Shanghai this fall. And, you know, if you go to China, if you've been to Hong Kong or Beijing or other major Chinese cities, it's so easy to find knockoffs there and of all sorts of things. And it's a really vibrant world of copying that's going on. And the Chinese government seems to either look the other way or not really make it a big priority. So that's really the crux of the issue, I think, internationally. So you're absolutely right that the internet makes these laws complicated to imagine, particularly for internet commerce. But in many ways, the real issue is how do you get countries in Asia primarily, but not only Asia, to enforce the laws that we think they should be enforcing.
All right. Well, since we're – go ahead, Charles.
Oh, as far as China, it's interesting because China, I think we've come a fair amount in terms of working with China to have them become better at having their companies and institutions comply with intellectual property laws. I think we still have a long way to go. But historically, China's philosophy was that content was owned by the people, not by any individual rights owner. And so I think it came from this difference of a philosophy that they had, and then working within this global community of other countries who disagreed with them and said, wait a second, there are reasons why we have intellectual property laws. And I think that the film industry has made inroads in having them work and comply with laws so that China could, A, be an important marketplace where it's not this hotbed of infringement as much as it was, and we're able to sell American products, films and television shows in China. But still, there is a long way to go, because I think it's a great distance that we had before us. And but I think it's improving.
Well, there's also this concept of, how do you say it, Cal? Shanzai culture?
Shanzai, yeah. I think that's how I say it. I'm not sure how Chinese people would say it, but Shanzai. And so, yeah, the Chinese, I agree with everything Charles said. I think things have improved from, certainly from the U.S. perspective. That said, there is – so Shanzai, I think, literally means something like mountain stronghold or bandit stronghold. But it's taken on this meaning in China of copying that sometimes is kind of overt and not really trying to hide the fact that they're copying things, and sort of celebrating it as a kind of way to it almost has like a social justice component. So we're going to take this cell phone, this, like, let's say the iPhone that the average Chinese could never afford, even though it's, you know, many parts are made in China. And we're going to knock it off and come up with a version of it that's going to be cheap and in some ways, you know, different, in some ways better. And we're going to sell that. And that's a really vibrant part of the Chinese economy right now. So that's what's interesting to me in China is this. There is a culture. So Charles kind of alluded to this. There is this notion, I don't know how accurate, that the Chinese traditional way of thinking is really very different. And so copying was a central part of how you got ahead traditionally in education in China. And to be honest, I see this in my Chinese students sometimes. They don't always get that plagiarism is a problem. So, you know, there may be something about the way that China has traditionally thought about copying and originality that's very different from the way we think about it in the West. And that may be one of the problems. But, you know, I hesitate to make those sweeping statements about a big society. But that's something you do hear pretty often.
And go
ahead, Charles.
Sorry. One aspect of it is, if your society is a consumerist society, then you don't mind the copying. If your society is a creating society, you don't want it being copied, because that could mean that other countries and other consumers are copying and you're not being able to realize the income from your creative endeavors. And so I think as China becomes more of a global participant in respect to creating as well as consuming, I think it will realize that it needs to protect the rights of its companies and its institutions when they create, that they don't want their products copied, and that there's a two-way street there. So I think that's part of it too.
I think that's right. I mean, it's certainly our story in the U.S. We were a huge pirate nation for a long time. And, the British hated the fact that we were ripping off their books, copying them left and right. And, we over time became a champion of IP rights as we developed. So I think Charles is right. We should expect that to occur. It's probably already occurring. But it's got a long way to go in China. If you look at, per capita income in China, it's still really low. So if we imagine that and we compare it to the same kind of transformation in the U.S., we should not expect a dramatic change.
So do you think Austria then will build a Great Wall of China replica somewhere, since in China they have replicated a little Austrian mountain town?
Right. I mean, that's part of this Chinese fascination with copying. I mean, it's that Austrian town. They love Western buildings. We recently, my co-author and I recently wrote something for Freakonomics about this building that's going up in Beijing that's being copied already in China as it's being built, which is not a kind of anything that's aping a Western building. It's a building by a very prominent architect. But there is a kind of love of the replica that Chinese culture seems to really celebrate or at least welcome in a way that we do some of that here. So we mentioned, I'm sitting here in L.A. We have this part of L.A. called Venice. And guess what? It was meant to be kind of a replica of Venice. And it had canals. And, you know, that was the whole vision. So maybe we're not so different. That was, I think, less than 100 years ago that we did that. So perhaps this is just supportive of Charles's idea that this is a kind of evolution that countries go through. But the Chinese do seem to be really into it, and they do it in a lot of different areas. So it's pretty fascinating.
It is. Well, Cal, I don't want to let you run before we get the chance to talk about Mega, other big thing in the news, and get your two cents on its potential legality as it unfurls and begins to be used by folks around the world. Mega, of course, is the second effort by Kim.com, who is under criminal indictment in the U.S. for Mega Upload, his initial foray into having a file locker site. Mega attempts to avoid some of the initial problems of Mega Upload in one distinctive way, having end-to-end encryption. So files are encrypted starting on the client-side computer and going all the way up to the server and back again. And Mega has no way of knowing, because of that encryption, what exactly is being stored on its site. Cal, do you think that that helps or hurts them?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think we've had this struggle for a long time between things that have infringing uses but also have non-infringing uses, you know, going back to the VCR decision in the 80s and probably beyond that as well. And so, you know, I think a lot of it, as I read some of the case law that's developed over the last decade or so, a lot of it does seem to go to this issue of maybe the courts don't say it in these terms always, but intent, and are you clearly trying to, you know, enable piracy or not? Or are you just doing this neutral thing that maybe will also result in more piracy? So I suppose you could view this as positive, but I think at the end of the day, there's still going to be a lot of skepticism, and people are going to say, look, you know, you're just trying to make it so that you don't really know, but obviously your business model is built around, or your intent is built around enabling piracy. So I guess difficult to answer, but I'm skeptical that'll make a huge difference.
Yeah, I'm sort of skeptical myself. One of the things I remember from the Supreme Court's Grokster decision, you know, aside from all the other factors of how you're trying to encourage infringement, was the invocation, the stir suffix. You know, are you trying to be like Napster, and we've called ourselves Grokster? Well, what is that supposed to mean? So, you know, if they were really... this may be a small thing, but if they were really trying to get away from the Mega Upload business model and stigma, then perhaps changing the name more substantially would have been a good thing to do. Yeah. Evan, I know you talked about this on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Can you give us your thoughts here too?
Yeah, well, I think Mega is probably going to be okay in large part under the DMCA. The courts have been very consistent in giving it broad application. And in the Grokster situation, which is, you know, not necessarily a DMCA, the facts of the Grokster case were supported the argument that there really was some particularized and active involvement on the providers of that platform to invite users to come and infringe. With Mega, yeah, we know what its motives appear to be. We know Kim.com and all his charisma and his character and all that stuff, but that doesn't mean that he's doing anything particularized to come to invite people, particular people to come and commit particular infringements. So I think in large part, the DMCA, at least in the United States, and you know, all of the effect that the umbra of protection that the DMCA would afford it is going to be pretty robust. Now, for me, the larger issue is not whether Mega is going to avoid copyright liability, because there doesn't seem to be too much unusual about that. Yes, I hear what Cal's saying, that there's this issue of whether or not they're willfully blind. And I don't know if you use those words necessarily, Cal, but I mean, it sounded like what you were trying to say, that, you know, that if,
no, I think
if,
that's
if
right.
a, But if a provider is going to become so willfully blind and ignore red flag indicators, we get that from, you know, like the ISO Hunt case a few years ago, to the point where they're almost literally an ostrich with their head in the sand. And incidentally, I don't think ostriches really do that in nature, right? But you know what I'm saying. Then, you know, maybe that's a problem that's going to erode the DMCA safe harbor protection. The larger issue for me is what it means to be a responsible citizen on the part of the intermediary, what the intermediary's role is in being a responsible citizen. And I think the real potential for harm to occur in a mega that is comprised of encrypted content going from user to user and made available is in the other kind of content that is up there. And because of it being encrypted, will be harder to police in the broadest sense. Child pornography is the best example of that. Other information that is per se illegal or, you know, presumed to be illegal other than infringing content. And so that's just, the negative aspect of providing a platform like what the new mega is that it would give that content a easier channel in which to travel. And that's unfortunate and has the ability to cause much greater harm than the type of infringement that we usually talk about right at first when we think about the new architecture on this.
Well, I see by the clock at the top of my computer screen that we have to let Cal go. He has some other obligations he needs to run and take care of. But we've been really happy to have you on the show, Cal. I hope we can do so again.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Denise. And I enjoyed being here and talking with Charles and Evan as well.
Sure. And I'm very much enjoying your book. And I hope that others will go out and check out The Knockoff Economy because it is a fascinating take on the culture of copying. So thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Bye. All right, Charles, I'm wondering whether I'm foreseeing an argument around this encryption that Mega is using, that Mega is making it harder for folks to use automated scripts, et cetera, to find what might be infringing material on there, they're going to have to learn of individualized links rather than having some sort of content ID system that's going to be able to look at these encrypted files, and that might actually wind up, although it helps Mega on the one hand because it helps them say we have this wonderful business model around protecting your privacy. On the other hand, it incidentally has a difficulty of finding infringing works on the service. Do you see where I'm going?
To be honest, I'm not an expert at Mega, so mm-hmm. I wish I had more to contribute on the issue of Mega, but I just,
sure.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. What do you think, Evan? Do you think the encryption thing's going to hurt them?
I mean, it's just going to be one factor among several in the inevitable attacks that copyright owners and perhaps the government again, I don't think that's real likely that the government's going to come after him again for what the new Mega is doing here. That's just going to be one factor. It's not going to be dispositive by any stretch of the imagination because he's not the first person to devise this idea of allowing a platform to transfer encrypted information. There's absolutely nothing mm-hmm. new under the sun when it comes to that. And never before has that in and of itself presented a legal issue, when it comes to copyright liability. It could really get interesting if we then get into the issues we've touched on a couple times in the recent past with the Fifth Amendment interest that a person has in not being forced to give up information to decrypt content that they're wanting to conceal. So I see that as an interesting little side tail, little vignette over here in one of the corners of the mega story that could take place, this whole issue of what Fifth Amendment right to keep yourself free of providing incriminating information about yourself might there be. But that seems unlikely to come up in the copyright context again, unless there's some massive alleged infringement going on.
Right. But in the cloud data context, you're absolutely right that Mega's going to be the subject of subpoenas, undoubtedly, asking for people's encryption keys to be able to look at the material that's on their service.
Yes, I trust that from what I understand, it's all built into the system to, you know, really be superly willfully blind.
superly willfully blind. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, you know, putting a blindfold on and putting, you know, running it in the completely opposite direction. And that's what I understand the architecture does. I certainly don't understand the nuances of how the architecture does that. But that's one of the features, is to really, truly be a platform where Mega just by no way, in no way could know what's going on its system. But that doesn't mean that plenty of other people wouldn't know what information is available there. And it's my understanding that Mega has already been, you know, received hundreds of DMCA takedown notices from content owners, even though it's just been up for, what, 11 days or so at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, the real effectiveness of the system depends on there being widespread knowledge of what content is available there. Even though there's plenty of honor among, I can't believe I was actually going to say that, because I don't want to characterize pirates as thieves. That's anathema mm-hmm. to what my very belief in. But I was on an offhand way used the phrase that there, even though there is honor among thieves. Again, I'm not calling pirates thieves. Okay,
thank you.
But there's going to be widespread knowledge, and the copyright owners are going to learn what works are, of theirs are. Available through the system, even in unencrypted or in an encrypted manner, so that the DMCA takedown notice would be forthcoming thereafter.
Right. There's an article at PC World talking about the various takedown requests that have already come in. And that was as of January 30th. There had been 150. I guess it's 150 warnings covering several hundred works. Beyond that. So if also this article references a search engine, much like there were for Mega Upload, trying to point people toward infringing materials that would be on the service. And it's mega-search.me, a French website, which obviously would have more trouble than I think Mega itself by trying to, you know, end run some of the superly willfully blindness, Evan, some of their ability to say that there's not infringing material on the site. So it does appear that, you know, hope springs eternal, and that if you want to sit back and enjoy your Django Unchained and let's see what else they found, Benny and the Jets and Microsoft Office, that the fact that all those things were available there could be aggregated. And I think, you know, the sites that do that have their own kinds of liability to be trepidatious about. Let's go ahead and take a break and thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile. In business, effective communication is key, as you all know. Sending emails with attachments that are too big, that bounce back, that just wastes your time and energy and certainly is frustrating for your client or customer. Dropping your files into online boxes for others to access is not safe or secure. ShareFile by Citrix, though, understood these challenges and created a better solution for your business. Now millions of accountants, lawyers, and other business professionals rely on ShareFile. ShareFile is so easy for anyone to use. It allows you to send files of almost any size securely. You can track the progress of your files, and you get notifications automatically when files are opened. You can control who has access by using tools like password protection. You can even sign and edit files for streamlined collaboration. Plus, with ShareFile, you can access files from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, or smartphone. So it really is the go-to business tool for anybody who needs to use cloud storage in their business and anybody who needs to share large media files with their clients and customers. I know that it has become my firm's extranet without my having to actually construct such a thing. It has the ability to customize the site so the experience looks just the same as what your clients are used to dealing with. And of course, your clients are always used to dealing with email. So when they get a link in their email to go and access a ShareFile file that you've shared with them, it's a very familiar and easy experience. So I want you to go ahead and take my special offer. You can try ShareFile for free for 30 days. Sign up for this 30-day free trial offer today with no credit card required and nothing to lose. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone, and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com, and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let us get back to our stories. Let us first, I wanted to drop in our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Let's go ahead and make that mega. And I wanted to note, too, that Eric Gardner had a good comment about all the legal hand-wringing about mega, and that is, you know, the technology itself is one thing, but you really have to see how the technology is used before you can decide what's going to happen with it on the legal front. So that happens now, as Eric says. So you can find his write-up on the legalities at our discussion points for the show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/196, along with links to all the other stories that we're discussing today. And one of the things right in Charles's wheelhouse has to do with the rights of publicity of the talent and other folks that you represent, Charles. I venture to say you've handled quite a few right of publicity cases in your day, yes?
I think I've had 28 major celebrity lawsuits and hundreds of non-lawsuits. That's right.
So it's a field that has been traditionally has grown up around the rights of celebrities, but it expands and grows daily as we all use social media more and more, and people have more and more public profiles. So I think that it's a really interesting thing to know and get your arms around. There are a couple of interesting areas that it's come up lately. I know we've talked before on the show about the question of athletes' likenesses being used in video games, not their names, but an avatar that could clearly be identified as star quarterback, football player, you know, pick your favorite, that is then customizable. But still, the draw for the game is to provide people with familiar athletes that they'll be able to play with. And so this has been litigated for some time. Charles, have you been paying attention to these cases?
I have been paying attention to the cases. I'm not counsel on any of the cases, so I can talk about them.
That's good.
To the extent that I know them. Obviously, if I was on one of the cases, I'd know a lot more about it, but I've been on the outside looking in, but I definitely pay attention because it affects the things that I do too.
Great. So what do you think about, I guess there was one case in California and one in New Jersey that have come out somewhat differently. The New Jersey case has come down on the side of, if since the people can tweak the avatars and, you know, they may start out looking like somebody, but they're not necessarily going to wind up that way when the game is played, that gives an element of transformativeness that takes a claim off the table and leaves the athletes out in the cold. Do you think that that was the right decision?
I think that was the wrong decision, and the district court in Northern California, I think, got it right when they said that it's an infringement, or at least it has the potential to be an infringement. And it's interesting because the transformative use test says that if you take a celebrity name or image and then you transform it into something that is different, then there can be a free speech First Amendment element that can be protected and thus non-actionable. But what the New Jersey court said is because because EA, Electronic Arts, created this game and allowed the user to transform, which the user didn't have to if it didn't want to, but the user started out with a player who is an actual person and their statistics and their number on their jersey and the team name. And I thought that they may have had the actual name in there, but I can't remember. Ryan Hart was the plaintiff, and I can't remember if his name was actually used in the video game. But it was enough indicia of his personality in that avatar and in the game that made it easy to identify him as a particular player. Now, EA did not actually change any of his stats, any of the look or the jersey number or anything, but it made it available for the user to change it. So the user would be the party that would be engaged in the transformation and not EA. But nevertheless, the the judge in New Jersey said, well, that's good enough for me. I'm going to say that's transformative. But in my book, that's not transformative. In California law and the law of a lot of the states is that if you use for a commercial purpose a name or an image or a voice or a signature of an individual, doesn't have to be a celebrity, it's just any individual, then you need to have permission from that individual to do so. And if you don't, then that can be an infringement unless a defense applies. And here EA argued that it had a First Amendment right to do what it did, and the New Jersey court agreed, but that's on appeal. And then in New York, in Northern California, the judge went the other direction, and that's on appeal. So we'll see what the courts of appeal have to say about this. And I almost wish that the panel in New Jersey or in that circuit and the panel in the Ninth Circuit in California would have some discussion among themselves and try to come to some consensus, because otherwise this is bound to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which has only had one case in the past on right of publicity, and that was the Zecchini case involving a human cannonball act that was filmed on a evening news show, and the Supreme Court said that it was an infringement to allow that clip of the man shooting out of the cannon and soaring through the air and landing into a net to be on the news program, because he had a commercial interest in people paying to see him rather than seeing him for free. So this could be the opportunity for the Supreme Court to take on its second right of publicity case. And of course, it always leads to the ongoing discussion of, well, shouldn't we have a national right of publicity law? Because every state has its own law, and some states have no law, but that's not to say it can't be made through common law or through statute, but it's an interesting host of issues there.
Would a federal law necessarily help it? Because even though that regulates what the right of publicity is, you've still got the way it would be applied in particular factual context vis-a-vis the First Amendment. You know, even though there's uniformity, people would be doing different things, developing games in different ways. Would that really go as far as what we might think on first blush to solving the problem?
Well, it wouldn't solve all litigation, because there's always litigation over the borderline issues. Is this situation transformative or not transformative? But it would help to establish the transformative use test, for example, as a defense, because that's a California creation, which the New Jersey court did apply, but other courts don't necessarily apply it. So I'm thinking more broadly in terms, not just in terms of Northern California versus New Jersey, but nationwide, where you have states that apply, they have their own laws and they apply them differently, and they have their own defenses and apply them differently. And so it causes a person to wonder what's going to be the law of a particular state if I bring a lawsuit there or I have to defend a lawsuit there. And that actually goes into the consideration of where you bring a lawsuit. In fact, I was debating this just yesterday, whether to bring a lawsuit in one state versus another state versus another state based upon the different laws that apply. We had a defendant in one place and a plaintiff in another, none of whom are in California. It would be easier if everybody followed the same law, although obviously from a talent perspective, we would want the law to be as strong as a state with strong plaintiff protections like California or Indiana, whereas defendants would probably like to have laws that apply that are consistent with a state that may not be as strong. So,
are you finding that the right of publicity comes up in cases more and more for everyday people?
Well, it's interesting because sometimes you'll have a lawsuit that'll be over something that doesn't really apply so much to right of publicity, but someone will put in a right of publicity claim because there would be a use of a name, for example, and there would be a commercial use of it, and so they'll just throw it in. But sometimes they don't realize the consequences because there's an attorney's fees provision that applies if you sue under the statute in California, for example, and some other statutes in other states. So If you put in that claim, you better hope to win that claim, because you could end up having to pay attorney's fees. But on the flip side, you could end up getting your attorney's fees paid for. And if you had other causes of action where you didn't have an attorney's fee provision, that gives you a leg up in that. Right of publicity has been used by people who are not celebrities. A famous case is Kristoff versus Nestle, where a male model had approved of the use of his image on coffee cans in Canada for a particular period of time. And then Nestle allegedly used, I think it's not allegedly, I think they did use his image on coffee cans in the United States and beyond the time period that he had permitted. Well, he was paid very little money because he was a model who was not well known. He was paid very little money for the initial usage, but then when he sued, he wanted a percentage of every coffee can that was sold that had his image on it, and he initially got a $15 million judgment, but it went to the California Court of Appeal, and the California Court of Appeal had some problems with some issues, including statute of limitations and also the basis for his expert opinion, and that went up to the California Supreme Court, and it came back down. I think it was ultimately settled, but that's a classic example of a non-celebrity getting a lot of money off of a right of publicity case.
So there are some sites out there that are being sued over keeping a database of mugshots. What they do is they aggregate people's mugshots and then get in touch with them and say, hey, unless you want us to, you know, splash your ignominy across the globe, you're going to pay us a bunch of money and we'll take this down. So there's an interesting write-up of this over at the Citizen Media Law Project by Jeffrey Hermes there that makes a good point that one of the at face value, of course, you would want people to be able to say, hey, that's my name and likeness you're using. You should not be able to shake me down with it. But he raises the point that use of someone's name and likeness for commercial exploitation has always been the crux of a right of publicity claim. And the way you get to that is to create a false impression that this person is supporting or endorsing or the product or thing being advertised. Although the Facebook-sponsored Stories case never got fully litigated, they've settled it. One presumes that's why, you know, that they were making a confusing association between Facebook users and the ads that were appearing in the sponsored stories. Charles, I'm wondering what you think about this whole mugshot thing and if you think that Jeffrey has a point here.
Well, my initial reaction, and I haven't looked into this in detail, but my initial reaction is that a website that is posting information that's publicly available and using a name or an image just as an informational source is probably not in violation of a law unless it's doing something more than that. And then when you get into this shakedown aspect, it may be crossing the line at that point, but I'm not too familiar with specifically about what exactly it's doing. But some examples are things like if you have a blog and you're posting images of celebrities wearing gowns and you're saying, I like this gown and I don't like that gown. Well, obviously that's First Amendment. When you start mm-hmm. getting into, oh, now you can buy this gown and click here and you can buy a knockoff of this gown and you're using the celebrity's name and image to help market and sell those products, I think you're crossing the line there. And so taking it into the mugshot example, I think that if you're just posting public information that can be posted anywhere and you just happen to be aggregating it, I don't see the violation. But then when you take it a step further to commercialize, it's possible. It's possible that that's a violation. It's a very uncommon situation, but it's interesting. And I get enjoyment out of thinking through some of these fact patterns. And obviously this one's an actual situation.
Yeah. Evan, what do you think of this one?
Well, it's there's something that's just really unsavory about somebody publishing this. I think the word that we're looking for, ignominy? Is that what you said?
Yes.
However you say it. About publishing this information that's used to disgrace someone. And I mean, maybe that's only one level of, unsavory conduct to publish it. But then you add to that and magnify that by charging people to have the content taken down. And in fact, I know that there have been allegations against Yelp, for example. I don't know how those have panned out. I just know that people have accused Yelp of putting people in a position where, hey, you want to get these negative reviews taken down, sign up and pay a bunch more money, and then the information will go away. Again, I'm clarifying that for the third time. I don't know that that's really what's happened. I just know that people have accused Yelp of that. So there's just something that there ought to be some recourse that someone has if they're really being taken advantage of and their reputation is the one that's being held hostage and leveraged in a way like that. I wonder what relevance that Section 230 may play in something like this. And that would the argument that Section 230 immunity would provide to a website operator would be we're publishing information that was provided by someone else, and we can't be treated as the speaker of that, and we're immune from our publication of that because this is third party content. I don't think that would carry the day. I see what I'm doing here. I'm just setting up a scenario and then just going ahead and knocking it down. I don't think that would carry the day because the real tortious conduct that's going on here, if there is any, is in that later step, the post-publication step of having somebody pay you money to take it down. Even if it was a right of publicity claim, that that's still not going to the providing of the service there. It's to that extra step there. So there's that. I think that it's worthwhile to at least consider what role Section 230 would play in this. But I think we're really starting to, by me suggesting this, probably stretching the framework of Section 230, perhaps to a point of to a breaking point in all this. But no doubt it's a claims under right of publicity for having to pay to take your mugshot down is it strains the right of publicity. But there's just like, this feeling that there ought to be something that a person can do in that situation. And I can't place exactly what that is.
Right. It's a little bit like the Is Anyone Up site that we've discussed numerous times on the show, except for they've never gone to the length of saying, if you pay us, we'll take it down. You know, they just like having the shots up there.
Right.
This is a slightly different animal, and there probably are some other laws that would come into play to address the sort of extortionate aspect of what's going on there. Before we leave the right of publicity, Charles, we talked last week on the show about an interesting case in the Seventh Circuit that Evan wrote up involving Joan Rivers. Had you heard about this one?
I read a write-up of it, and I can't remember what the facts are, if you could remind me.
Yeah, sure. In general, someone was making a documentary film, and the plaintiff in the case was having a conversation with Joan Rivers after her just concluded act. She had been heckled, and they were talking about that, and it was a documentary about the stand-up comedy world, and the clip made it into the documentary. Let's see, Evan, who was the plaintiff in this case?
It was the woman who was in the audience, mm-hmm. and somebody had filmed her having a conversation with Joan Rivers backstage. Mm-hmm. And, the content of the conversation was about a heckler, and the woman talking to Joan Rivers, who later ended up being the plaintiff. I mean, the clip didn't make her look all that good because she was kind of she was trying to criticize a heckler, but really the heckler was making some good points. So, I mean, in any event, when it ended up in the documentary, plaintiff felt like she didn't look really good, that she was kind of cast in a bad light. And so she asserted that the inclusion of her name, or at least her image and her likeness in the documentary, misappropriated her right of publicity under Wisconsin law. And so, and there was also a an invasion of privacy claim as well. And the court tossed that because they're essentially, the quick and easy way of saying it is there was no expectation of privacy in the context. But then as far as the right of publicity claim goes, there was the court threw that out because of the larger public interest in the documentary. And then also there was just an incidental use, which I thought was the most interesting part of the case. It almost sounds like the de minimis exception under copyright law. It was just a tiny portion of the film. And from what I understood, this coming under Wisconsin law, that statute is modeled on New York's right of publicity statute, which contrary to the observation, or it's not contrary, but contrary to the things identified in Charles's observation that California and Indiana are pro plaintiff right of publicity states. I get the feeling that Wisconsin and New York, being one and the same essentially under these doctrines, are not so pro plaintiff when it comes to the right of publicity. I don't know. I'm just taking a very small data set to draw that conclusion. I haven't done any further investigation. And so that's what happened in that Joan Rivers case that we talked about last week.
Well, it's an interesting situation. There are a lot of cases. I call them face in the crowd cases, where the camera will pan and there will be a bunch of faces in a crowd, and one face may be on screen for a second or two, and they'll bring a lawsuit hoping to get some money out of it. And the courts will say, well, it was de minimis or is incidental. It just wasn't enough to really merit a claim where there would be damages paid. And in Joan Rivers' situation, I assume, but I don't know, that when there's a taping, that the producers will let the audience members know that this is being taped and the tape will be used. And one of the elements of right of publicity is permission. Did you give your permission or not give your permission? And so if somebody is going to be in the audience during a taping and start heckling and see the cameras filming, you don't have an argument that this is non-permitted use. Although I suppose if the producer said this will be used for XYZ and it will not be used for ABC, and then they do use it for ABC, then I guess you have an argument there. But I think courts tend to – they have some leeway there, and I think that they tend to rule that if there's a usage that's pretty small – that they're not going to allow that to take up the court's time and a jury's time, because you're talking about something where the damages are probably just so little, if anything, and the liability is just so questionable that they're just not going to allow that to occupy the court's time. But
Charles,
that's not to say, look, but sometimes I always say, well, what if it was not 9 seconds? What if it was 9 minutes? What if it was 90 minutes? What if somebody was followed around and filmed and then somebody created a documentary off of them? Then I think you have a different situation. One thing about right of publicity, though, is if it's in the context of a film or a book, and courts are holding that if it's in the context of a video game, that you're getting into First Amendment use as opposed to pure commercial speech, which is to take an image and put it into a television commercial to sell a product, putting it into a billboard that's selling a product, which goes under a different context. So this is where the battles are fought, though, is this particular medium a First Amendment medium, or is this a commercial medium? And if it's a First Amendment medium, is First Amendment free expression, is that the purpose of this particular speech, or is the purpose really just to sell a product and the usage is really focused on that, in which case you could have a right of publicity situation even if it is a First Amendment medium, because there are certain obstacles that you have to overcome. So, I mean, I can't say that I would disagree with what the court had to say in the Joan Rivers case, but I always say, well, what if this and what if that, and if the facts were a little bit more in favor of the plaintiff, at what point in time would a reasonable judge have to say, I'm just going to allow the jury to rule on these factual issues as to whether this is a commercial use or not a commercial use, or if the judge wants to take that up himself in summary judgment and say, I'm going to say this is commercial. I'm not going to say this is permissible. And I've had situations where judges surprised me in how they ruled on things, where I thought that something that was equivalent to this I've represented defendants as well, and I had a case where I felt that there was a situation that was similar to this Joan Rivers situation, and it was in New York. And the judge allowed that to go to the jury, and I was kind of surprised. It was an image on a shirt, and the image It was the back. It was the back of the person's head. It wasn't their face. It was the back of somebody's head, and they sued over putting that on 300 shirts. But the point is this: you never know which judge you're going to get, and what their biases are going to be, and how they're going to view a particular situation. And there are cases where there's a very, very strong right of publicity case, and the judge throws it out. So judges have a lot of power in those situations.
We had an interesting question from Virgil in IRC about face in the crowd issues. What happens when someone like the Rolling Stones makes a concert video and everyone in the crowd becomes part of that video? And, my thought on this, without letting you answer it first, is that they sign away those kinds of rights when they purchase their ticket to the event. Is that right?
Well, it could be that, or there could be an announcement made during the performance, before the performance, mm-hmm. before the person even goes to the theater, saying this is going to be filmed, and everyone gives their consent to have their image used. But even so, even if there was nothing stated about that, there is case law that says just because you're a face in a crowd doesn't mean that you have a right of publicity claim if your face ends up on a DVD for a second or two.
Mm-hmm. Are you starting to see more claims brought under this statute as people become more and more aware of it and cameras are everywhere? You know, we're all carrying HD cameras on our phones we're living in a society where people are constantly filmed by each other. Is that changing the face of right of publicity law?
Well, it's interesting because there is more and more and more content that the internet has created, this explosion of new content and technology. The little camera that's on my computer right now, that's adding to the content that's out there in the world, and all the other little cameras and the phone cameras and everything, it's all adding to the content. But to answer your question, there have always been a few face in the crowd cases and things that are like that, and like the Joan Rivers type of case, that get filed, and they typically get dismissed. And so I wouldn't say that I would have seen a larger number of those types of cases now that we have this explosion of content on the internet. But there is probably additional activity. I mean, obviously the internet has created a lot more legal issues, and a lot more claims are being filed on a variety of different things. For example, we were talking about some of these consumer websites where people would post content in Section 230. And so there have been a lot of lawsuits about that because of the explosion of the internet. But in terms of just the increase in video content because of YouTube and cameras and phones, I wouldn't say that I've seen a large amount of it. And I'd say that the courts have been fairly consistent in how they've ruled in the past in their rulings in the more current cases, which is it needs to meet certain thresholds in order to be a viable claim. And once it's a viable claim, then you have your jury trial and the jury will decide it.
All right. Well, we're going to get into some more of those ways in which the internet is altering the law in a moment here. But right now we're going to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is LegalZoom. Evan?
This episode of Twill is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm, no, but provides self-help services at your direction, such as affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code Twill, that's T-W-I-L, to receive $10 off at checkout. So if you've been waiting for the perfect time to start your dream business, it's right now. Incorporate your business or form an LLC at LegalZoom.com starting at $99. Forming your business the right way can save you money on taxes and ensure your personal assets are legally protected. LegalZoom can also help with trademarks, copyrights, patents, NDAs, and more. All that difficult stuff. And if you have a family, guess what? You need to make sure they're protected too. Yes, you can protect your family and assets with a LegalZoom will for just $69 or establish a living trust. If you don't have a will, you leave it up to the government. in courts to decide what happens with your family and assets. And we all know how that could go. In the past 12 years, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom for LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more. LegalZoom's online process guides you step by step, so it's easy to use and you get total customer support. If you have questions or need advice, you can even access an extensive network of attorneys through LegalZoom's legal plans available in most states. You can search online profiles and unedited customer reviews to work with a LegalZoom plan attorney who's right for you and your business. So start your business and protect your family today at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm. You get self-help services at your specific direction, or you can speak to a legal plan attorney to get your questions answered and get ongoing advice. To receive a special thank you for listening to LegalZoom through the TWIT network here on TWIL, make sure you enter the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L, in the referral box at checkout to receive $10 off. So go to LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TWIL. We thank LegalZoom for their support of TWIL. Back to you, Denise.
Thank you so much, Evan. Let's talk right now about law and the social web. Well, we were talking about this a bit before the break. The internet really does change so much about the way that we interact with each other and the things that become public and readily available for public consumption. There were some interesting stories along these lines this week, including tweeting a receipt, tweeting a firing, and something, Evan, that reminded me a lot of taking a picture of underwear on council table, posting a picture of an officer's 911 discussions to Facebook. So why don't we start with that one, Evan? Tell us what happened there.
You know, we're getting a long list of these kinds of cases where people make bad decisions on what to post to social media. This was just a very, very short opinion that came down from the New York court. I don't know exactly where it is in like the New York hierarchy, but it was an appeal from some kind of state administrative agency that fired this. I guess he was a 911 operator. I know that he was a lieutenant in the New York Fire Department. So I don't know exactly what his role was, but he, in any event, had access to a 911 operator's computer screen and saw the details of what a caller was calling to, reporting on an emergency. And so there were some embarrassing facts about what the caller's physical predicament was. And perhaps what is worse, or certainly what compounds the problem here, is that in the photo of the computer screen, it not only had that complaint, which were some embarrassing facts about the caller, but also her name and I think her phone number and possibly her address. So certainly personally identifying information about this person. So what did he do? Of course, he uploads it to Facebook, and he had 460 friends, and some of them liked it. Long story short, or short story long, as we're getting to this point, he got fired. Sought review of that with the courts. The court says this was just completely unacceptable behavior. I don't know what term they use, but they were like, there's just no justification for acting like this. Yeah, it was the right thing to fire you. So really the big thing that comes out of this is perhaps doesn't instruct us so much about what the legal analysis should be, but to just remind us about the bad decisions that people can make using technology in the courts or in the administrative system, and the courts certainly will hold people accountable for that. So that's what happened in a New York courtroom this past week.
I guess the takeaway from that is if you're going to post something like that, of course, the guy got fired, so that's the consequence. If you're going to post something like that, you know, make sure that you've removed any potential identifying information for the poor person that you're posting about. I mean, still you could be fired on bad judgment grounds, but you know, here there was a confidentiality consideration as well. Charles, any thoughts on this one?
Well, it's interesting because there's the law of what's private and what's not private. What can you post to the internet and what can you not post? And if this is something that's public, then you may well be able to post it on the internet. But if you are doing so in your using the employer's tools or equipment, or during your time working for the employer, then obviously the employer has an interest in what it is that you're doing. And if you are a person who has bad judgment, obviously an employer doesn't want employees with bad judgment. So that's kind of a safety net that we all have, which is that employers can step in and take action on their own just to protect themselves. But the underlying legality is, what can you post to the internet and what can you not? And that issue seems to be getting broader and broader. There are a lot of things getting posted to the internet that are not necessarily against the law to post them, although a lot of us think, gee, there should be a law against that. There's a case from the California Supreme Court where a person was in an accident and was medevaced in a helicopter from the scene of the accident to a hospital. And there happened to be a news crew in the helicopter filming as part of a documentary or a news story, just kind of an ongoing following the medevac group as they went about their day. And this incident happened and they filmed everything. And the person who was the victim sued for invasion of privacy because she, when she was getting health treatment with a doctor in the medevac unit, she was filmed and then that was posted to a television show and she never consented to it. And the California Supreme Court said, well, the communications that she had with a doctor were privileged communications and should not have been posted publicly. But all other aspects of that rescue were fair game. So when the medevac jumped out of the helicopter and gave her aid and then put her into the helicopter and were filming things that did not include her communications, that was all legal to post, and she didn't need to give her consent. So that's where the California Supreme Court happened to draw the line in that particular instance. And it can give guidance in situations like this. And Denise, I completely agree with you that I think that personally identifiable information should be removed, but sometimes people don't. And so the question is that a violation of somebody's rights? And if it's maybe it's something that the 911 system needs to deal with, which is if somebody is calling 911 and all this information that needs to be communicated to the responding emergency personnel, such as name and address and condition and all the rest of it, maybe there needs to be some redaction of information before it becomes publicly available. And so I'm kind of questioning why it is that information got released without there being some kind of redacting of it, because I think it is dangerous for an individual. From a public policy perspective, if an individual is thinking, well, gee, if I call 911 and I'm having an emergency, but yet the people who are responding are going to be communicating personally identifiable information about me, maybe I don't want to call 911. Maybe I want to call my spouse or somebody else instead. Well, that may be a dangerous situation because they really need to be treated by medical personnel. And I think that the 911 system needs to take into consideration that potential or propensity to cause a chilling effect on people. And in the public policy reasons, they should have some sort of redacting of information and policies in place and policies followed that protect the victim in situations like that.
Yeah, it's a larger issue than just privacy and those expectations that you're talking about there, Charles, because, I mean, this has to do with the personality and the sensibilities and the common sense of law enforcement and emergency personnel, because fortunately, I don't guess anybody died in this New York case that we're talking about, but it bears a certain resemblance on a number of levels to the case from California that I think was resolved in the last year or so, called Katsouris. I don't know if it was more in the news out there. I mean, I certainly remember seeing this wind its way through the court system. Long story short, again, there, I said that again. why don't I just tell the story? You know, the young woman died in a car accident and was it was a pretty egregious scene. And the California Highway Patrol officers who took photos at the scene distributed those on the internet. And, you know, that was just a horrible thing for them to do. And I know that there was, you know, that went all the way up, and I think there was a settlement in that case. But that goes, the real point there is it's like, gosh, you know, use some common sense. If you are put in that position of public trust, if you are an emergency responder or a 911 operator, whatever your role is.
Absolutely. We want those people to have to guard the public trust. I couldn't agree with you more. But isn't there, especially because we're talking about state employees here, don't they have some kind of First Amendment concern as well? I mean, I don't know that the First Amendment would extend to allow you to take some confidential and compromising information that you learned on the job and post it online. But it seems to me there's at least some tension there.
In the Katsouris case, it's my understanding that the appellate court held in California there was not a First mm-hmm. Amendment interest for the officers in that particular situation. So in as much as that answers the question, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that government employees do have – there are certainly different First Amendment standards that apply to them than mm-hmm. what, you know, in a private employment context. And when it's the public trust, that just really makes a difference. Seems like we're bouncing around a lot of issues where it's kind of hard to articulate how you really do that. But right. that there is a fundamental distinction there where you need to know if you're going to call 911. This is what the point Charles was making, that there shouldn't be any, you shouldn't experience any hesitation or reticence right. to do that because of your privacy interests. You need to just be worried about what the issue is. And it would be unproductive for us as a society for it to be otherwise.
All right. Well, a slightly different situation where someone's privacy interest was recognized, but really, I don't know how much privacy you could reasonably expect to have in this particular circumstance, was a pastor who visited an Applebee's. He was part of a party of eight or more, so the standard 18% tip got added to the bill, and he annotated the bill, refused to leave the tip, put a big zero where the tip amount would be and said, I give God 10%. Why do you get 18? Which the waitress fairly sympathetically thought was outrageous and took a picture and posted it, tweeted it actually. She got fired, the poor thing. But I guess it just underscores what you were saying, Evan, that First Amendment rights are different for federal versus private employees or government versus private employees. And here the restaurant went out of their way to apologize to the pastor and fired the girl. So what do you think about this?
There's a little bit of everyone in this story because you've got the religious connotation, you've got the poor waitress, you've got the sensibilities of the member of the clergy that was offended in two different ways. I mean, offended first that Was it a he or a she? I can't remember.
The pastor was a she, says Padre SJ in IRC. Thank you, Padre SJ.
Yeah. I mean, the pastor was offended at having to give the tip and then offended that it was, you know, made public and then, you know, was sorry. So, I mean, there's just all this stuff here. I mean, I think tithing is an Old Testament concept anyway. We asked Padre about that. So I don't know.
Exactly. But Charles, I mean, it's indicative of a larger trend that, you know, things, when would you ever expect your restaurant receipt to wind up on Twitter? But, you know, in today's day and age, you have to think about those things if you're going to do, especially if you're going to do something, you know, that's kind of societally reprehensible. Do you agree?
Well, in today's day and age, you walk out the door of your house and you're fair game. You walk into a restaurant and there's the potential that you're fair game. And I don't necessarily agree with a lot of the things that are going on, but that's the society we live in. And it's really hard to stop it unless there are laws that are passed that say this is what you can and can't do. But in a situation like this, and again, it goes to the employer being the safety net here, if you want to look at it in that context, which is employers have rights too, and they don't have to have employees who do certain things that cause a customer to feel uncomfortable. And from the restaurant's point of view, if this employee did this with regard to a pastor, then what else is that employee doing with regard to other customers? The restaurant has a reputation that they want to protect, that you're free to come in and leave whatever tip you want based on whatever service you want, and you shouldn't have to be afraid to come in and patronize the restaurant for that. Obviously, there's another perspective, which is this is an employee who was working really hard, presumably, and didn't get the tip that she felt that she was entitled to as a sort of a society norm, and that when the pastor fought this and did this, that she had the right to take a picture of it and just let the world know. Did she do anything illegal? Probably not. But does the employer have a right to regulate who is the employees? Of course. So everyone just has additional considerations when they walk out the door and interact in our society, that now that we have the internet and we have cameras that or telephones in our pockets that take pictures and the ability to put that up on the internet in a second, it's just additional things that people have to think about. And there are consequences that maybe 10 years ago you never would have thought of, but they are a reality today and they're part of being in our society. And the laws are changing as we go along to reflect certain things. But I think there are still some legal norms, which is employers can regulate their employees and people can express themselves in the First Amendment, which allows them to do that. And I don't see this as anything different than the ways things have been. It's just the technology is making things faster and easier.
Let me make two more points. First, that pastor should forgive the waitress, and so she should get her job back. But I wonder if the pastor actually could be liable criminally for theft, because I mean, at the for not leaving the 18% gratuity, you know, striking out and purporting to say zero and all that stuff. Because isn't it your under? I mean, if you look at the fine print at the bottom of the menu, and you know, there's not an Applebee's. I'd have to go a couple miles down the road to go check the Applebee's tonight. But you know, it seems like if you're saying that you have that agreement, you have that understanding, it's almost as if there is a contract that has been formed.
It's a terms of service violation.
Yeah, it is really. And so, to the extent that you have agreed to do that, and that's the nature of the arrangement, and somebody is withholding money, you know, we're making it much more complex than it needs to be. But you know, kind of the side issue would be whether or not they could have had the pastor arrested.
All right. Well, we talked about two people who got fired, turning the tables a bit. A firm called HMV, a music retailer, had a mass firing that went live on Twitter as it was happening. The first tweet of the bunch said, "We're tweeting live from HR where we're all being fired. Exciting." And the whole thing unfolded online. Once again, it's just an example of you think you have a confidential employment-related act taking place, and as long as the employees feel like they have nothing to lose, they're losing their jobs anyway. Don't think you can keep that under wraps. Evan, do you think there's any particular legal twist on this one?
Probably not a legal twist, just yet again, a situation where people should just do the right thing and have value and be grown up about stuff and not make yourself look bad by being a whiner. Maybe I would feel differently if I was in the position of just having lost my job like that. So maybe I should be measured in my criticism of others like that. So I don't see what the point of legal liability or the risk for that is in this situation. It's just that this is a difficult situation for an enterprise to be in, because you know, no matter how much rulemaking and guideline promulgating and policy implementing that you do, when it comes to the point when you are having somebody who has the keys to the magic social media drawer for your enterprise and they're being asked to leave, there is a very precarious situation that you're in for something like this to happen. And Fortunately, I can only surmise that this happens pretty rarely, and perhaps not inevitably in the life of every enterprise. But boy, it just it's a risk that the enterprise faces when it does put a person or a small group of people in the position of having the voice, the soapbox to talk to the whole world like that.
Right. Charles, I don't think there's anything that could be done to really stop something like this. I mean, obviously before doing a layoff, if one of the people being laid off is the person who's managing your company's social media account, that's something you want to maybe be mindful of before going forward. But, you know, there's just really no way to shut this kind of thing down. I think companies just have to be smarter about the way they do things. Do you agree?
I do agree. And it goes back to the point we were just talking about before, which is they're just additional considerations now that phones are everywhere and microphones are everywhere. You just have to think it through a little bit better so that if you're going to do a mass firing, maybe have people come into a room and leave their telephones and other devices at their desks and then come into the room and then you have the talk with them about what's going on with the company and that you can't let them, that the company can't afford to keep everybody on anymore. But if something like that gets tweeted, what can you do about it? I mean, obviously, you may have a situation where every employee signed a confidentiality agreement. They agreed to certain terms and that they wouldn't make public things that happened within the four walls of the company. But realistically speaking, what are you going to do? File a lawsuit against somebody who tweeted that out? And if you do, what are your damages? And can you go after damages? It's really, it starts to get murky. And then, of course, you're just going to snowball this issue of company that does mass firing and has no heart is now suing person who posted a video about it and seeking X number of dollars for damages. And it's just bad PR upon bad PR. So, again, I think it's more of a practical consideration for an employer or just about anybody who's interacting in society that there are cameras out there and there are microphones out there. And maybe one positive thing about all of this is if there's the possibility that what you do is going to end up on YouTube or end up on a posting of some sort on a blog, maybe you need to be extra careful about conducting yourself in a proper way so that if somebody did post your interactions, it would be the way that you'd want to be received as opposed to a moment in time where you lost it or flew off the handle, you did something wrong. So I'm not personally.
Right, and that cuts both ways. That cuts for both the employer and the employee who, you know, is going to have to further down the road find new employment and doesn't want the fact that, you know, they bashed their former employment in the firing process to haunt them. And also, you know, they may well have some sort of bonus or severance or some sort of, you know, we're letting you go package that might be in jeopardy if they do something to tick off their employer. So although it could be very empowering for employees to do this kind of thing, I think, you know, it's something that requires a little bit of restraint and consideration before firing away on Twitter if they're at all concerned with what might happen in the future. Let's go ahead and make HMV our second MCLE passphrase for the show. If you want information on obtaining MCLE or other continuing legal education or professional education credit for watching TWIL, head on over to the twit.tv wiki for all the shows. And on our TWIL page, we have all the information there that you need. Let's go on to our tip and resource of the week. The tip of the week goes right along with our right of publicity discussion, and it has to do with the settlement in the Facebook-sponsored stories case. Evan, I don't know if you ever used Facebook long enough to receive one of these emails. And Charles, I don't know about your social media usage, but I did receive one of these. And it is, in fact, a legitimate email. For anybody who is at all a little bit net savvy, I hope that you at least considered whether this was legitimate when you received it, because it takes you out to a site where you're supposed to put in some personal information to be able to participate in the settlement of the Facebook-sponsored stories case, which had to do with using people's name and likeness without their permission in a commercial way on the Facebook site. So this is, in fact, a legitimate link. This is how they are signing people up for the settlement. And the fact, you know, there are just all kinds of ways. I went through and clicked through and examined everything and, in fact, did sign up to be our participant since I was eligible in the settlement. But I'm telling you, they're trying to amass this pool of people that can participate in any payments that are going out. And there are just all kinds of road bumps in that process. You know, at first, you're going to be suspicious about getting this kind of email. And secondly, who's going to really go through the process? I don't know how many people, you know, once they're there and assured that it's real, are really going to take the time. But it is legitimate. And if you do want to participate in the Facebook sponsored stories settlement and you get one of these emails, you can go ahead and sign yourself up. You've got until May 2nd to do so. They're careful to say they're not promising any payout. The payout, if it does come, isn't going to be more than about $10. And if they wind up having too many people sign up such that they can't do, you know, a meaningful payout to the class, they're going to take the $20 million that's set aside for this purpose in the settlement and donate it to charity. So either way, I think it's a good thing to go ahead and make the claim. Either you're going to get a little bit out of it, or if lots of people do get over those road bumps and decide to do this, then a charitable organization will benefit from it. Any thoughts about this, Charles?
I actually might have a conflict on this, so I can't talk about it. I'm sorry.
All right, that's fine. Absolutely. We will move on to our resource of the week, which is new as of, I think it was January 16th. It is the Docracy Terms of Service Tracker. This is following in the footsteps of Tossback from EFF and other sites that have tried to keep track of all the various terms of service out there and their iterations over time. So Docracy is making a run at this now. They have over 1,000 stored versions of various terms of service. So if you are interested in knowing how things are changing over time, this is the place to go. It's good to see it because Tossback had been getting a bit out of date. So I'm glad that Docracy has picked up the challenge of trying to monitor all the terms of service out there. Evan, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is a good service. And it seems like something that ought not to be too technologically challenging to be done. And in an ideal world, we will see the consuming public when it comes to websites, and particularly with mobile apps, being more informed. And this is a tool for doing that. I mean, that's what I just talked about as an ideal. I don't know if consumers will ever, you know, actually make the much more effort. So perhaps things like this, and then of course the California Attorney General putting more emphasis on mobile privacy, and just today the Federal Trade Commission introducing a report about mobile application development and privacy. These types of things, hopefully what we see is a shift toward ease of use for the end user, so that their legal interests, so they can learn more about what their legal interests are and understand what kind of rights and obligations they have in these types of agreements that nobody reads.
All right. Well, I am so sorry, everyone, that you've had to labor through my voice on this episode of This Week in Law. I'm just happy to have a voice at all, because yesterday I didn't. But I thank you for sticking with us. And I thank our great panel for taking the laboring oar today. Charles, it is so nice to connect up with you again.
Same here, Denise. It's always a pleasure.
Tell us about your new firm.
The new firm is called Harder, Morrell & Abrams. We are entertainment litigators and entertainment lawyers, and coming from different firms. My partner, Doug Morrell, was at Loeb & Loeb for 32 years and a summer associate before that, and he decided to team up with myself and my other partner, Jeff Abrams, who was at the firm I was at before. We have 7 attorneys right now, as of we've been in business for 1 month, and things are going well. We're very excited, and it's exciting and it's fun, and we're making a point to enjoy ourselves as we go along and do things. So it's great.
Good.
It's awesome.
You know, we talk about technology law on this show a lot, but increasingly there's so much overlap with the entertainment arena. So we really appreciate being able to get your perspective, and we hope we can do so again sometime in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. Just let me know.
All right. And Evan, wonderful chatting with you again this week.
Yes, the same. Always fun. Always a highlight of the week. And glad you made it through this. And I hope that your panel discussion goes, or the panel that you're speaking on, or the presentation I know you're giving this afternoon. So hope that you can rest the larynx for a while and make some success with that. And Charles, very nice to meet you. Let's be sure to connect and stay in touch. Sounds like you're up to some really, really great things. Congratulations on launching the new platform. I know that's exciting.
Thank you, Evan, and it's nice meeting you. And we should get together one day and share notes.
For sure. All right. Well, thank you again, Denise. And I'm looking forward to next week.
Me too, as well. We'll see everyone next week on This Week in Law.